What's going on, Radu Zewego? For those of you who are just joining us, this is Our Voices with Ganatogo Hemlock, and this is episode 3. And on tonight's show, we have Joe Diome, Laura Norton, and Nancy Deer. And also, tonight's show is brought to you by the Mohawk Super Bingo on Route 138. And so, once again, we're going to be continuing with our discussion around the whole education movement that happened here in Kahnawake. And prior to even getting started with this discussion right now, I was talking with Nancy, and she corrected me when I said we're going on 40 years now, but she said, well, no, it's actually been closer to 50 years that Kahnawake has really taken a hold of its own education. So I really felt it would be important for our audience and those who might not know the history of Kahnawake education and how it was that we took back our education and why it was such an important thing. And so I would just want to ask any one of you who would want to jump in was, what was it that really led towards this retaking of our education system here in Kahnawake?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for inviting us, old timers. That question is really important because what I know happened before, I didn't get on the committee till 1975. Mm-hmm. And if people don't remember, because it's such a long time ago, like almost not 50 years, but say when I got on, it was like 40 years ago. And what I want to refer to is the Joint Unification Agreement. Mm-hmm. And let the people know in the community that our schools were run by the federal government, and they hired nuns,
priests,
you know, nuns for the Cattery School, and there was a United Church Day School. Mm-hmm. So those were the two primary schools in the community, and the services that they were receiving were inadequate, especially for the United Church mm-hmm. Day School. Insufficient resources, teachers, and they knew of, you know, the parents who had sent their children to Kattery, and they start talking, and what the Protestant committee did was contact Indian Affairs and get things rolling, and that they wanted better services. And in that process, they told the Catholic parents, you know, because that's it, to form a committee, mm-hmm. and the Protestants formed a committee. And then they met eventually with Indian Affairs and some members of the Mohawk Council at the time, mm-hmm. because we did an interview with those former members who were still, who hadn't passed, Penny LeClaire, Marlene Scott, and Jeanette Malush, mm-hmm. I believe, and Shirley Scott, and... So we got that history, how they started. So eventually they wanted, someone had recommended at that meeting, and I believe she said it was the superintendent, Penny said it was the superintendent of education, mm-hmm. who was in Montreal, who said, well, why don't you join the schools?
All come together.
You know, so they talked about it, and it was a difficult process because we were told when I got on the committee by Rita Phillips, who was the Catholic representative at the mm-hmm. time, that, you know, it wasn't easy. Anything that is done in education is, you know, you bring it back to the parents, and so that's what they did. So, of course, there were benefits. Mm-hmm. All our kids would be going to school. It would be the a non-denominational school, but that would provide religious instruction for the Catholics. They would have catechism. The United Church Day School would have Bible study. Mm. And those who were not non-religious, or the Longhouse children, the traditional parents of Longhouse children sent them to the United Church School. So that's how the joint unification came about. Mm-hmm. So that was like... historic.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's what started the process. They, you know, they knowingly knew what they wanted for their children, mm-hmm. and they knew that within that federal system they weren't satisfied, and they wanted the best quality education.
And so from that time, at the beginning when you first started really having that joint unification and really taking hold of our education system, what were some of the hurdles that you guys had to get through at that time in order to get where maybe you wanted to get to? Was it internal? Was it external factors? What was really kind of things that you had to really move through in this process?
I think it was both. I think it was both internal, in that the Catholic parents and the Protestant parents wanted to maintain the status quo. Mm. But most of the parents on both sides wanted to have equal opportunities for their kids. Because, let's face it, we're all related, whether we're Catholic or Protestant or Longhouse today, we're all related. So everybody was concerned with their children, that they had at least the same level of services in the school system. Mm-hmm. So that was the driving force behind the unification agreement. And the other thing, there's always budgetary issues, and Indian Affairs always takes a long time to provide adequate budgetary support. So after that started, and before Nancy and I got on the committee at the same time, they also had the issue of billings, where Indian Affairs provided Indian money to help build the Billings High School into a centralized school, which housed about 2,000 kids, and was really overpopulated. And we had about 400 kids going there at that time. So during that time, before 1975, they had turmoil in Billings, in that the kids wanted language instruction and cultural instruction, and they wanted to have services in the way of counseling support by our own native people, and that's where Kenneth Deer got involved in that process. So all that happened before Nancy and I were.
And also during this time, the Longhouse had started Indian Way School, right?
That was around 1973, and that was the. I learned later on that was the first Indian controlled school in the country, and as a result of the negotiations between the Longhouse and John Chiacha, who was assistant deputy minister of Indian Affairs
years later, right?
At the time, and he was the chief negotiator on that issue, and as a result, they got their funding directly from Treasury Board, I think. I'm not totally sure, but I believe it was Treasury Board directly to the Longhouse.
And so what did you really see happening in this time? Because we have Indian Way School over here starting, we have this joint unification starting, and there seems to be something swirling within our community at that time. And what exactly was going on?
I look back at it, it's what was happening all around the country, you know, especially in the United States, at Wounded Knee, AIM, and there was a resurgence of activism in
it even seems within Kahnawake at that time that the Longhouse is starting to kind of come out of the shadows, because Dwayne Itatsu last week, he was mentioning how prior to the 70s, it was kind of like underground here in our community, right?
Yeah.
And so maybe by the 60s and 70s, that starts to come to the forefront too.
And then there was the evictions.
Yeah.
And that created a turmoil here. I was sorry, I missed all that. I was working away at that time.
I witnessed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the Longhouse made a stand for whatever reason that they made the stand at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, this was 1973. Mm-hmm. And soon after, I believe what I was told later, they wanted, that's when they moved to the first Kanyange.
Yeah, must
so like. So yeah, you have, you know, you have the awareness of going back to the homeland. You know, Kanyange, where we're in New York State, where we originally came from. And so that too, sanctioned, I heard later, by Grand Council, and and went to the first, I believe it was Moss Lake, and then later on negotiated where they are now.
Where they currently are today.
So, you know, the awareness was happening, like Joe says, because of what was happening in the United States too. And you know, both governments, I can only say Canadian government, they weren't very happy about this activism.
I guess not.
Because, you know, when we got on in 75, you know, we didn't know that there was a lot of problems at Howard S. Billings. And there were walkout. There was prejudice. There was stereotypes. There was stereotypical behaviors that teachers or others, non-Native, had of our students. And so when there was conflict, our students would get suspended. Sometimes the non-Native student wouldn't. So, you know, you saw the prejudice. And so there was a sit-in, I think Kenneth very told us before, after we got on the committee, there was a sit-in. And then they called the parents and to, like, talk to their children, to get them back to class. And once they heard why their children were protesting and acting out, they stayed in the auditorium with them and they supported them. And then, you know, certain things, they did get Mohawk taught, they did get a teacher to come in to teach Indian studies, and they also, Kenneth was the school counselor, student counselor. So when I got on the committee, I was replacing the late Janine Bova, who had been the Howard S. Billings rep. So she took me. We met directly with the principal and Kenneth so that we could track our students, you know, how they're doing. I think we did not want a place on the school board, and plus they wouldn't allow it anyway because we're not taxpayers,
Know.
So it was an education, I find, you know, that that was eye-opening, and it was a lot to do with Kenneth being there and being open. I remember one time he invited the Howard S. Billings teachers to the Longhouse. We met with Rita, and so she gave orientation, you know, like to kind of like understand where our students are coming from, and not to have these ideas of wrong, you know, prejudice
the regular stereotypes and racism that we were facing.
But the other thing that happened, I think it was 1969 or 70, the white paper came out from the government.
69.
And basically that was a deal to transfer all that responsibility that the federal government had for us to the provinces.
Yeah.
So we would be under, you know, their curriculum, their whatever, you know, and
it was really a shot at our sovereignty, right, at that time.
Yeah, for and what it caused was across Canada, starting in BC and spreading, and it was a
termination policy, basically.
And so it's interesting to think about it, because prior to that, right across Canada, we had these residential schools. On the state side, we had boarding schools, billions of dollars, hundreds of man hours put into them, and then all of a sudden, out of the 70s. We get this resurgence again of wanting to learn our language, wanting to regain our culture. So it's like, even after all of that happened, it still wasn't stamped out of us, you know, and it was still, that fire was in us. And like you said, you know, I'm sure the feds in the provinces at that time were a little ticked off because, you know.
And the basic, really, a reason for the termination policy was assimilation, you know, that they wanted to get out of their responsibility to us. And make us, you know,
good Canadians.
Good Canadians.
Yeah, not us.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And
we're half-assed Canadians.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a paper they called the Red Paper, Indian Control of Indian Education, that came out of that maybe
the response, right?
The response 2 years, maybe 3 years later, and just before that, that's when Indian Way School.
Well, let me go back on that because of the negotiations with the Longhouse, John Chiacha proposed a policy for the federal government to follow, which was Indian control of Indian education, and then that went around the country. And I think the NIB at the time, which was National Indian Brotherhood, which was the precursor of
the AFN,
picked that up and enrolled that in their red paper. Let me go back to when I got on the committee in 1975. I had just moved back permanently here, and I had my sons enrolled in the school. So the first school committee meeting, lo and behold, I was nominated, and I got on the school committee. And you know, I didn't think there would be much
much to do.
You know, cake and cookies every once a month and tell the stories. Boy, little did I know how dynamic the women on that school committee were. And
that's the thing I always find interesting is that
powerful.
It was just like this powerful group of women.
Absolutely.
Is what I always hear. You know, it was like men, we had such a...
Yeah. I was a token male on the school committee, so they made me the spokesperson. Mm-hmm. And... I really had to just talk about to the public about what the women were telling me to do. The other influential person on the school committee was Earl Cross, who was the Longhouse representative. So not long after that, Bill 101 came around, and lo and behold, we had to ask permission to the province to send our kids to Billings or English schools anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it was Earl that brought it up and brought it to our attention. And that's where the school committee decided, you know, the hell with this, we're not going to ask permission to send our kids to school. Mm-hmm. So parents by that time, some of them had already signed the certificate and made the request, and to make a long story short, we left it up to the parents. We had a meeting, and they agreed not to request the certificate, and then the kids weren't allowed to go into school the first day of September 1978, and everybody walked home from Billings, and then we had a big meeting at the Knights of Columbus and kind of review what we had done for the day. And then it was, what do we do with the kids now? You know,
we're just good at winging it. Huh?
So, yeah, well, we figured that the government will Quebec will back off after a week or so. And so a week goes by and nothing happens. And in the meantime, we're talking with the government, you know, Eric Gordeau, remember? Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was the guy who was representing Quebec in this situation. So just about every day I had to call him, or he called me, and me and Kenneth had to deal with what he had to say. And everything he said, we passed it on to the committee. Mm-hmm. So they even offered to... build an arena for us here in Ganawaga if we would have our kids
go back to school.
So, you know, I had to make that offer to the parents and in a meeting, and boy, unanimously they said no way. Mm-hmm. So we stuck to our guns, and to make a long story short, we decided to start our own high school. And with nothing, we borrowed books from the English school school system in Montreal, tables, chairs, and desks, from all these schools that have been closed now. Mm-hmm. And so, and then we used every facility available in town. So the first day of school was scheduled over the weekend, and Philip Deering did all that scheduling, and he had a wall full of sticky papers to, this was before computers, so so we had a school going like over, you might as well say overnight, and we've been at it ever since.
40 years, right? Next year is the 40th anniversary of that school. And it's such an interesting thing that came out of an act of defiance, that came out of a political response to them trying something again, you know, and us really saying that we weren't going to go for it.
Well, the parents, even before all this happened, had wanted to have their own high school. Mm. I think there was a referendum sometime. That was before 1975.
At the election that year, there was a referendum at the band council elections in July.
To have our own high school.
And two questions that we asked was, you know, yes or no, would you want a high school and a junior high school? Mm. You know, like we're
so
going to start.
So the seeds were already there.
Yeah, the seeds were there.
It was like the province or the feds, whoever it might have been at that time, just added water to that seed that was already planted.
And the other thing is that Philip Deering and Janine Bova had written in 1977, just before...
Oh, yeah,
2 years after we got off on the committee, Indian control of Indian education to study our own system.
Yeah,
let me tell you how that came about. Wanda Goodleaf and I were appointed by the school committee to attend a conference in
Blue Quills
near Edmonton,
mm-hmm.
and so there was all a. Indians from all across Canada there, and they all had, they were asked to give their experiences on Indian control of Indian education, and Wanda and I were coming from a federally controlled school system, and the only thing we knew that was Indian control was Indian Way School,
mm-hmm.
and we knew very little about it at that time, but so we talked about whatever we knew about it. And Wanda knew more about it than I did because mm-hmm. I'm just new to the community, basically 1975. So so then I came home and so I was rummaging around in my head. So I thought that we should do a study on Indian control. And I thought maybe we could get it done over Christmas holidays. And I talked to Eddie Cross, and I said, well, you know, what do you think? So we tried put something together over the Christmas holidays. He said, yeah, sure. So we never got to it at all. So then I said, well, we're going to need some money and hire somebody to do this. So I went to Ronnie Kirby, who was chief at the time, and I said, do you think there's any money for this study? Before I go to the school committee, I want to know if there's something available.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I'll look into it. So then he says, what he does, he calls John Brisbois, who was the superintendent of education at the time mm-hmm. in Montreal, and tells John that says the Longhouse wants to take over the schools.
Always those troublemakers, huh?
So that goes back from Breezy, John Brisbois, directly to the teachers, you know, federal mm-hmm. teachers. And they're up in arms, and they start yelling at the school committee, and I don't hear any of this. And then the school committee says, it calls me up and says, what the hell are you doing, Joe? You know, boy, I was on the carpet. I had to talk to the teachers and the school committee, and I had my hat in my hand.
So it was a real interesting time. There was a whole lot going on, you know, in our community at that time. A lot of movement happened. For those of you who are just joining in, we're here with our three guests, Joe Diome, Nancy Deer, and also Laura Norton, who we have yet to hear from tonight. So we're going to put her on the spot in just a few minutes. We're talking about the history of regaining control of our education here in Kahnawake and some of the things that happened throughout the 70s and these important movements and some of these movers and shakers who were at the forefront in our community during that time. And once again, this this show is brought to you by the Mohawk Bingo on the 138. And so now I want to ask Laura, in all of this time that we've been doing this now, we've been regaining our education. There's been a lot of movement within the 50 years that we've been at it. Garuinuha, Indian Way, Gariwanoru, Kahnawake Survival School, Kattery starts to take its, changing things over from having priests and nuns and so forth. So a lot happens. Where do you see that we've come in 50 years? What's the growth that you see has happened with our community? And where do you see that it's brought us today?
I think it's made people, not all people, but I think most people are very consciously aware that that if you have control of your education system, then you have control of the future. And education really and truly is a mechanism that governments use to make good citizens. That always comes as a surprise to people in this community. It comes as a surprise to most people because that's not the reason they think they're sending their children to school. For me, I went to school here and I went to school in New York. I always, always went to a Catholic school. And I really and truly was never subject myself to the type of racism that was so prevalent here and in the United States, because I went to very progressive Catholic schools with extremely progressive ideas. And but I was aware of racism, and I was aware of racism because my father and mother told me about it. And I was always, and I have Longhouse family. And so I think what really shocked me was how mean we were to one another in those days. We're not quite that mean anymore. I think most of the young people, because they all go to school together and because they're learning this, that, and the other, I think that is not a barrier anymore. That whole idea about your Longhouse or your Protestant or your Catholic, it's not really that much anymore. I think that people are trying to that next generation. I'm talking about my grandchildren and that generation doesn't have that, and they really find it strange when you try to tell them that there were separate school systems. They look at you like, well, why? You know, and when you try to explain to them, well, it was this, this, and this, they go, ah, that doesn't make sense, because those are not the problems that they have. I think in that way we've moved forward. The other thing is that people don't always talk about is that the 60s and the 70s were very exciting times for North America and the world. People were rebelling against everything. It wasn't only First Nations people that were rebelling. Other people rebelled also. You had massive exodus from the Catholic Church by priests and nuns who wanted, not because they didn't want to be Catholic, but because they wanted to do other things with their lives other than be subjected to certain restrictions because they were priests and nuns. I remember listening to a conversation with a woman who was chancellor of a, I can't remember what university, but it's a Catholic university, and she was a nun. And she went to meetings without her habit on because she said they treated her, who had two PhDs, because she was like a little nun. So she stopped wearing her habit because it didn't because she wanted to be treated as an academic. So all of this was going on the outside. And then on the inside, you have this group of people here who are walking around saying, why are our children not getting the right proper education? These children play with one another and then they have to be separated and not go to the same schools. These are people that I socialize with. These are people that are my family. And that barrier started slowly drifting away. And I think it's really good. I do think that we need to, I think the next step that we need to take is to look at a curriculum that's going to, I think, make better citizens out of our people. And the whole idea of citizen, I don't want to use that word, but I can't use a word for citizenship. I think we need to start going from other to other communities and seeing how this is going to work to make all of us stronger.
So in the context of even taking it beyond Kahnawake and looking at ourselves as the Mohawk Nation again, and the connection back to Confederacy and our laws and our everything that makes us us, right, is what you're saying?
Yeah. I think the thing that I'm hearing from people that I've talked to is that they would like to have, for a better word, some sort of a CJEP where adults can go and learn about things, you know, Confederacy, whatever.
Political thinking, social science.
And I have very interesting, I had two young men who are, both of them must be about 19 years old now, but that said what they wanted to know was, they wanted to know about wampums. And I said, well, yeah, there's this, this, and this. No. They said, not the wampums. They wanted to know about wampum. What kind of wampums do we have with the Inuits, or do we have one? And what kind of wampums? So it's, they're thinking on a like an international level of an international indigenous level. And I said, geez, I don't know. I could ask somebody. Mm-hmm. Well, why don't they teach that? They weren't looking at it there. They were looking at something for them as young adults. And I thought, so do they want the school committee to find a CJEP? Are we looking at Bob Antone's university? What are we looking
that's
at?
That's something that's been swirling, it seems like, is that this conversation around a university, you know, and this idea of taking it further. What are the next steps, really, is what we have to look at. And I wish we had more time tonight, because I'm just looking now and we've run out of time tonight already, you know, but there's just so much that can be talked about. There's so many areas that we can go into. And I want to say Nyawakoa for coming in and really sharing a lot of the information that, you know, I myself didn't know about either. And I think it's really important that we encourage our younger ones to go and visit the ones who were there during this time, because it's really key. It's a part of our living history that we still have today. And it's really important that we don't take it for granted. Like I said earlier, we had so many trendsetters. We had such a powerful group of women and people who were there supporting that group at that time in the 70s. You are all part of that. And I really want to say Nyawakoa for putting the time that you did in when you did and continuing to do so. Because when we look at education, we still see your guys' faces there. We can see that you're into it.
When will they go away?
We love having you there because it's that connection back, right? It's the connection to what happened before and where we're at now and where we're going to go into the future. So I just wanted to give that acknowledgement to yourselves, but also to all of those elders at that time who really put a lot of time and effort. And we have to say, we have to really, you know, raise them up in our community to say we wouldn't have what we have today if it wasn't for the movement that happened back then. So Nyawakoa again for coming in tonight and being part of this mini series that we have going.
Yeah.
And we'll be right back. Nyawakoa.